Hello, gorgeous. Welcome back to Tony's House of Tea. I'm glad to be with you today because podcasts are one of the ways I can still feel connected to people during this time of social isolation and craziness. So hopefully this episode will help you feel a little less alone too. We here at the MT are always happy to chat and connect with you if you're feeling isolated and to spread all the love we can. This episode was born out of a presentation I attended at the GLR conference a few weeks ago on why music therapists are leaving the profession. It was such an interesting topic, I knew I had to get the presenter on the pod to share with all of you lovely listeners. So, grab that old mortar and pestle, grind up those leaves, and throw them in some water for 3 to 5 minutes, because here comes this month's episode featuring special guest...
Jenny Branson.
Jenny Branson, MS, MTBC, is an experienced clinician and educator with a passion for advocacy, the potential of every person, and interdisciplinary collaboration. She works with other allied healthcare providers to increase awareness and understanding of music therapy, ensure quality music therapy intervention to improve clinical outcomes, and translate research findings into clinically effective programming in the real world. These skills and interests help her create a medical music therapy program that serves a large hospital system throughout the Louisville metropolitan area. The program serves adult and pediatric populations in both inpatient and outpatient settings, provides clinical training opportunities for students and professionals, and conducts research to help advance the field of music therapy. Jenny is in private practice, serving Southern Indiana, Louisville, and beyond. She is available to provide continuing education, classes, and workshops, consultation for programming, supervision, music and wellness interventions, and clinical music therapy intervention. Let's start with just a little bit about you and what got you interested in this topic.
Okay, so I'm what you might experience, describe as an experienced clinician. I've been in the field for nearly 16 years. I've worked in a private practice setting, but mainly worked in a large hospital corporation. So my first job was actually my dream job, and I was able to build a large music therapy department within a hospital system in a metropolitan city. So it took a long time, but we were able to do it, and we were able to create 8 jobs that are in the operating budget for that corporation. So those are jobs that have full benefits, that are secure, that have a regular schedule, that are located on site and have all of their equipment and continuing ed provided.
Wow.
I left that position about 2 years ago and completed another degree and started doing a little bit of private practice work just to keep my hands in the work and also making myself available for consulting and supervision. So I'm now facing all the challenges that music therapists out in the world experience with contract work and low wages. And right now, no work because we're all in social isolation because most of our clients are considered at risk or fragile.
Yeah, it's a rough time out there right now.
It is. And honestly, the older you get, the more you realize that the contract business model really is not sustainable for many people, because if you are the main wage earner or the only wage earner in your household, that's a pretty tenuous situation to be in, because it doesn't take a lot to disrupt your contracts or to disrupt your work. If you're sick or injured or something happens in a facility or in your community, that can really disrupt your work. And also, you don't have paid time off and you spend a lot of time doing unpaid work, planning, driving, disinfecting, documenting, networking, marketing, all of the things that are required to maintain that model of business require a lot of unpaid work hours. Some people are wired for that, some people are not, but I know for myself, as I get older, that model does not work. I have other obligations. I also don't have the energy I had 20 years ago. And my priorities have changed. You know, what I need or want to focus on or the places I want and need to be are very different. And contract wages haven't changed very much in the 16 years I've been working. And that's a long time to not see a change in the rate. But the price of things out in the world has certainly changed. So my bills are very different than they were 16 years ago.
Yeah. Do we know, like,
how, if the majority of music therapists are contractors or employees, or do we have, is that information anywhere?
Not reliably, because all okay. the information that we have is self-report, and not everyone reports, and we don't know what people choose to report when they do.
So it sounds like there's already a challenge of getting accurate information
right.
on these things.
Right, and there's not a clearinghouse for facilities to report if they employ a music therapist and in what capacity. That, I think that would give us another data point. You know, we're not going to get a complete picture, but if music therapists are reporting fairly frequently and then facilities are also reporting, we can at least have a comparison.
Okay, so why are people leaving music therapy?
I only know why my people are leaving, and that would be the people in my circle and people that I work or know, and then the folks that were in my study. So I tried to pursue a study that was grounded theory to examine that question, because asking folks why they left the profession is not a question that lends itself to a survey or that lends itself to a short questionnaire. Or any type of pre and post. You know, I could not ask them before they entered the profession how they felt and then after they left, because I couldn't find them. So it was a grounded theory question. It drove that approach and technique. And so I was able to complete this project as part of my master's thesis and research in music therapy. And I was able to interview 13 music therapists from across the country that had been board certified either the NMT certification, like the National Music Therapy Certification from the before 2000, or MTBC after 2000. And they were certified between the years of 93 and 2016. So we had multiple decades represented. We also had about 9 training programs represented in the study, and we had 6 states in 3 different AMTA regions represented. So I tried to find folks from a range of settings and a range of years in order to get a picture to find out, did the reasons change? Because the reason why you leave in 2016 might be different than the reason why you leave in 2005. So I was very strategic in my sampling. So with grounded theory, you don't do random sampling. You do purposive and then you do theoretical. So it was specific, but it was also very broad. So I was looking for people who are still in the workforce, not that had just left the workforce, and that was the reason they left music therapy.
Gotcha. So people who retired didn't count.
Exactly.
What do you classify as working in the profession, so we can like set up a clear definition?
I did not operationalize it for my study. I let the participants define that for themselves, but I was looking for people that were doing music therapy, working as a supervisor of a department, or teaching a music therapy course in a university, something related. Either you're teaching students, supervising students, providing intervention, doing music therapy research, something that could clearly be traced back to music therapy. So again, these are self-reports, so that's also a consideration when we think about the bias and we think about the quality, validity, and credibility of the study. I think it was valid information, but we do have to consider that these were individuals who were willing to tell their story, and that's very different than individuals who are compelled in some way to complete an exit interview. So my question was driven by my own curiosity as a professional, because I've always been interested in professional issues. I came to the profession as a non-traditional student. I was an equivalency student. So I came to it with a different perspective than an 18-year-old. And so I've always observed the professional issues and tried to learn more about them and to watch to see how or if they evolve. So that was one motivator for this study. Another was my own experience with music therapists that I knew, music therapists that I trained, or music therapists that I just met out in the community, and conversations that I had with them just anecdotally. I was hearing a lot of the same thing. And I wanted to know, was that just, you know, because of the crowd I was hanging with, or because of the types of people I tended to run into, the types of businesses I frequented? Why was I hearing the same information over and over? Mm-hmm. And is this the same information across decades?
What were you hearing? Can you speak to that a little bit?
Sure. A lot of what I was hearing was about the salaries, was about the difficulty in doing the work, not the difficulty of the clients or the emotional intensity of the work, but the day-to-day work of driving, of planning, of contracts, or of being in a similar role, not necessarily a music therapy role, but maybe an activity assistant role or a rec therapy role, and not being supported or respected. But the bulk of what I was hearing was financial. Some of the comments I heard were, you know, the best thing I ever did for my career was to get married so I have a second income. A lot of folks were leaving the profession for similar professions like social work because they felt like even though the pay wasn't that much better, the jobs were more secure because reimbursement was available or there were jobs posted in their area. Folks were able to find work, but the work paid similarly across the country. So even if the cost of living in an area required a much higher pay rate, the pay rates for the music therapist didn't necessarily reflect that. So they weren't finding work that paid a living wage or a sustainable wage. I was also hearing that there were really only two options. You could be an entry-level itinerant music therapist, or you could get a PhD and teach. So once they had been in the field for a number of years, there was nowhere to go with it unless you decided to be a business owner. There weren't leadership roles or other roles within the profession.
Yeah, I see a lot of that. Yep, I hear those things too. Resonates very strongly with my own experience.
Well, and that was something I was aware of in 2004 when I was board certified and started working. I anticipated and hoped that the profession would evolve. But depending on where you live and what you're doing, it doesn't always feel that way, or it doesn't always seem that way.
Yeah.
And the community where I live, it does not seem that way. Really, the only jobs posted are entry-level contract work or working at the university, which requires a PhD.
Yep, same thing up here too.
So for my own self, that was frustrating and sad because there was nowhere for me to go. And so I was working on my master's thesis. I had a different research question. It fell apart. And so this was a question. It's like, well, I have this important question. No one has answered it. We see a lot of articles in the literature about burnout, but no one really finds out what happens to people. We know people complain about burnout. There are a lot of sessions at conferences that talk about self-care and that talk about burnout, but nobody's following up with people to find out where they go. Like, all of us know someone who left the profession. Do we know why, really? You know, have we asked those hard questions? And if we did, was it just their friends that asked the question? Did the university follow up to find out where their students are now? Did CBMT follow up to find out why they didn't recertify?
Oh, so who has the responsibility to keep track?
Right. Or the initiative, you know, really who? I think a lot of us would benefit from that information, but no one's tracking it. And that was one of the things I learned in my study. One of the advertisements that we see right now in the profession for recruitment of students or other professionals is that there are over 8,000 music therapists board certified, which is true. That number is a solid number. It's an objective number. It's true. But we don't know how many of those are working or how many hours per week they're working or what their salaries are. We don't know if they're even working in the profession. I don't think there are 8,000 working in the profession.
Why do you think that?
Well, I'm not working in the profession, honestly. So that number is already not correct. And I casually know 10 or 15 music therapists. And I say that because they still say I identify as a music therapist, even though they're working in other professions. So I know casually and through my study, people that maintain their certification, but they are not working in the profession at all.
Why do you think no one is tracking those numbers about where, how many people leave, where they go, salaries, all that jazz?
I don't know. Speculation could be there aren't the resources. Maybe they aren't concerned necessarily with all of that information. They just are concerned with how many people pass the exam and maintain their certification each year. It is a hard question. I don't know if anyone wants to ask that question. I don't know if anyone wants to compile that information. Because if we have that information, then prospective students might have access to it, or universities might have access to it. I don't know how that might impact the growth of training programs or the, you know, the growth of the profession. I think not having it is detrimental to the profession, because then we can't fix problems. If we don't know where the problems are and where the holes are and where the supports could be shored up, we can't fix them.
It's like our, it's like our profession has that like problem that we all have, is taking an honest look at ourselves and
right,
being super honest about it. That's interesting.
Like doing a performance evaluation of the profession.
Interesting. And I think there's a lot of political ramifications that come with that. If universities, if prospective students, if these different people have access to that information, absolutely, and the field isn't quite what we say it is right now. Yeah, there's a lot of things, a lot of things that could change.
Right. So it's interesting that it doesn't always feel like we're using our critical thinking skills and our research survey skills to look at our own work. You know, we would never allow a student or a colleague to use data that's this incomplete to make an argument. Yet we make this argument all the time to encourage people to join the profession or stay in the profession.
Wow. Oh, that's wild that you just said that. That's, oh man, that's a whole nother thing, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Ooh, it's like ethical now. It's like,
it's a huge ethical question. I actually struggled with that because I was teaching an intro to music therapy course for non-majors, a survey course at a local community college. And at the same time, I was doing this study. And it was really difficult to remain engaged with the profession and excited, and to convey excitement to the students who might be considering the profession as a change to the profession. Because we had to talk about professional issues. And so we spent a week looking for jobs in the area and talking about the jobs that were posted or not, and the pay ranges posted in our area, and how, you know, you need to think carefully. It's not an easy degree. It's not an easy certification to maintain. What kind of lifestyle do you want for yourself and your family? And do you feel like you could reasonably pursue that?
Wow. Yeah, I just started teaching an intro course, and I actually really like that idea. Taking a good long critical look at it that way. And doing those very concrete things of job searches, salary searches, if you can find it.
Yeah, and you cannot. I have made a project recently of Facebook messaging most of the people posting jobs and asking them for salary information. They're not very happy with me, but they're not posting it. And if you go on Indeed or Glassdoor or any other job posting platform, there is at least a range posted. I mean, even Target has their range posted on the front door.
What did your study find on why people are leaving the profession?
So I expected to hear a lot of different stories and to have to comb through a lot of disparate information, but I kept hearing the same story. And when you do grounded theory, you can stop interviewing when you reach what we call saturation, which is when you keep getting the same information over and over, like when you feel like you will no longer get new information. Knowing that, I could have stopped after three, but I had the resources and the interest. I pursued 13 interviews. So the three main points that we came to were that people left for, there were three reasons. One was lack of access to sustainable jobs. The second was having access to support, so peer support or administrative support. And those were equally important. They felt like they were equally absent in their work lives. Having access to a network or having access to a supervisor or coworkers that were supportive. And then the third thing was the burden of advocacy. And it was not the advocacy of going out in the community and explaining what music therapy is. It was the advocacy for self. And the way a lot of the participants explained it was advocating to be allowed to go to work and do music therapy. So they felt like there was constant pressure to produce data, to produce outcomes, to produce reports, and to explain why they should be allowed to have a job in that place.
Oh, God, that one hits hard. Yep.
And I actually was talking to a student who was in my cohort in my graduate program. And this student was much younger than myself, had been at the facility for 2 to 3 years and had felt established and felt pretty good about the position. But now administration was telling this person, you have 1 year to prove to us why we should keep you.
Wow. Oh, that hurts.
It does. And, you know, we're not trained for that.
No, we're not. We're not trained.
We're allowed to go out and work with a bachelor's degree, but we are not trained for these battles that we are being forced to wade into. And if you are asked this really difficult question by an administrator who's in charge of your job, and you don't have the tools to know how to do that, and you don't have access to peer support or other coworkers that can help you navigate that, that's awful. That feels terrible.
Yeah. I do a practicum at a children's hospital here. And I'm always telling my students, you know, track numbers, track anything you can, and make sure you write it down in your notes. So when an administrator says, what do? You can say, look, I can bring heart rates down. I can increase oxygen saturation. This person used less pain medicine, da, 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 da. Because you need that.
You do. And stuff. In the system where I worked, we also tracked across the 5 hospitals. We tracked the number of referrals, the source mm-hmm. of the referrals, like whether they came from family or from other clinicians. And we tracked the number of people that we could not get to. And a lot of music therapists hate that idea. But my theory going into it was you need to be able to demonstrate that there's a demand that you can't meet. Mm-hmm. And if that demand is generated by nurses, that's a big deal.
Yeah.
And so we were able to consistently grow over the years because we could show that there was a need for our services. And yes, we had clinical outcomes and data related to individual sessions, but it was really that the other nurses, the respiratory therapists, the physical therapists were requesting our assistance. Mm. And clinicians aren't going to ask for an extra thing if they don't believe it helps.
That's true. Yeah. Okay. So that burden of self-advocacy. Of mm-hmm. being enough, of being not the expert, but knowing enough to be able to be in the room.
Right, to be allowed to show up and go to work.
Yeah. Oof. Let's talk a little bit more of lack of access to sustainable jobs.
Sure. So I think only one of the participants moved just because they wanted to be in an area because, not because they needed to be near family. So 12 of the 13 were looking for work in a specific geographic area for multiple reasons. And the majority of them, it was, you know, my family was there, or that's just where I wanted to live, you know. So to me, that rang true. Like, I live here because I want to live here. I'm looking for work here because my people are here. They were looking for one job. Most of them had held multiple jobs. Like, maybe they had a contract job that had multiple contracts, but then they also had other jobs to help make ends meet. So working retail or teaching private lessons or doing some other side hustle in order to make ends meet. They wanted some type of benefits. Most of them reported zero benefits like health insurance or pay time off or sick leave, disability insurance. And they were looking for salaries that were still low. They weren't looking for huge salaries. They were looking for things like into the $40,000 to $60,000 a year range, even in 2019.
Mm.
So they're still not looking for a middle-class salary. They were just looking for something to cover the essentials. there was one participant in the study who lived on the West Coast and did make a salary that was appropriate for their living area. So they did have one full-time job with benefits and a salary that met their needs, but they still were recruited away to another job because it was just easier.
Wow. I've always heard that you can pick your location or you can pick your population, but you certainly can't have both.
I don't know that you could have both and sanity.
Ah.
You know, my situation was very serendipitous. I had my location and my population. But I also had a second income. So the only way I was able to afford my job for the first 10 years was that there was a second income in my household.
Hmm.
So yes, I built a thing that now employs a lot of people, but I could not have lived on that salary successfully that entire time.
Right. Yeah. And so the idea of privilege starts to be woven in as well.
Too. Absolutely. Yeah. And I was always very upfront about that with my students and with my staff.
Mm-hmm.
And our salaries were determined by the corporate HR and their algorithm. It wasn't something I could impact for them.
Mm-mm. Do you know how corporate determined that?
I don't. But when I was working on this study, that was one of the questions that came up. I was like, well, how are music therapist salaries determined? You know, everyone's told to use the AMTA workforce survey, but what is that mm-hmm. based on? I mean, that's based on self-report of a select few. And so I looked at the Bureau of Labor Statistics and I looked at the MIT Living Wage Calculator just to get a sense for what's out there. What are other professions making? Where do we land on the scale? And the thing that was really shocking was that according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, their music therapy is not a profession on their website. I know they can't include everything, but we're not listed. So if an employer looked at that website, there's no information. So depending on whether they place us in the music workers category, which is any music job that is not education. So that could be gig workers, private lesson teachers, performers, or they put us in the health professions and technicians category. That could change the rate. I know that the corporation I worked for looked at other professions that only require a bachelor's degree and that require some type of certification or license. So we were more in line with dietitians or rec therapists.
Okay. So like, can you give me an average?
So the therapists for that corporation were starting out around $18 or $20 per hour. And if they were full-time, they did have a really nice benefits package. But you know, $18 and $20 an hour is not sustainable for a very long time for a grown-up.
Yeah. Yeah. How much do you think we should be paid?
I don't know. It definitely should change based on your years of experience. And that's one thing that's frustrating is that it doesn't seem to change. You know, when I email these job posters and say, well, I have this many years and this many degrees and advanced trainings and all of these experiences, it doesn't change. So I'm being offered the same as someone with 2 years of experience. So I think it definitely should change based on your years of experience and the roles you've had. But I don't know that $40,000 to $60,000 a year would be unreasonable. I don't know of any other profession that gets a degree and says, I'm going to go out and make $30,000 a year. You know, what are other professions with a bachelor's degree making?
I guess I have no idea.
Right. We don't. And that's another thing we need to discuss as a profession.
Oh, God. Huh. Ooh, it's bringing up lots of good points being made today. Very cool. Okay. So overall, what were the systemic factors that kind of made people leave the profession? Were there any? Did you find any?
They were institutional and they didn't change across demographics. So whether the participant was male or female, no matter their age, And in my study, the participants identified themselves as either male or female. So no one self-identified as non-binary or gender fluid. It just so happened that the folks who volunteered to participate identified either or. So the factors were sustainability and isolation and advocacy. We really didn't talk a lot about professional governance or association issues. I did have a question for each of them at the end, and this was more curiosity. It didn't feed into the or build the theory that at the end of the study, but I was asking each of them whether they lived in a city or near a city with a university training program and whether they felt like that provided access to support or supervision. I think
what did they say?
All but one did, and they consistently said that that program did not provide a sense of connection.
That's really sad, but also is maybe an opportunity.
Right. I live within 2 hours of at least 4 training programs.
Any of them offer supervision or connection?
No.
Yeah, I was just thinking the one I teach at doesn't.
Now, the one that I completed used to, but, you know, directors change and programs change. So there's no longer that sense of connection with the community.
Okay. What about personal factors? Things like burnout, things like it wasn't right for me or anything like that.
Only one of them reported that. And that person knew it when they were in school.
Oh, wow.
But were encouraged to complete it. And that person actually left the profession to do something else, then came back to it to earn money while they were pursuing a different graduate degree.
Huh.
But the graduate degree was, you know, what they landed in was education. It was early childhood education. So it wasn't so different. It was the same population they had been working in, but they just didn't like working with trauma and clinical issues. They prefer working with training and education.
Yeah. So it seems like it's the, what did you call them? Institutional factors more than the personal factors.
Right. I did ask each participant how they felt about their training, if they wish anything had been different. Most of them had a positive perspective on it. Looking back, you know, their retrospective was positive, felt like they had a solid foundation, but consistently they did not feel like they were prepared for the job market. And that feedback was stronger for the participants that were certified after 2005.
Oh, so the later you're certified, the less prepared you felt.
For this small sample
size. I'm not sure you can generalize that. Yeah.
For this sample size. So one person actually did say, I felt like I was sold a bill of goods.
Oh, wow.
Some of them reported hearing information from their training programs that, you know, there's work for people who want it. And I've heard that. You have to really want it. You have to go out there and build it, things like that. And some of them just didn't want to do that. They weren't wired for that, didn't feel like they were prepared for that. You know, some of them just want to show up to work and go home.
Yeah. I've always heard that too, that there's work for those who want it. But it's like, but what kind of work is it?
Right.
Because I can't work part-time.
Right.
And live.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, for me personally, just observing conversations and hearing conversations that people have with me, like, well, we need to give people permission to say, this is hard. I don't know that people feel like they can ask for help or that they can say it's overwhelming. We see the highlight reel on social media and on the association websites and at conferences, and I don't know that people are having conversations that people in the real world can identify with, that the clinicians out in the field can identify with.
Hmm. What do you think those conversations might look like? What do you think we should be talking about?
We should be talking about how to retain our therapist, how to provide leadership training, you know, encouraging them to get training in civic organizations or other degrees in business. Talking about what is a respectable and expected salary. You know, if you have a bachelor's degree, this is how much you're going to make. If you have these other degrees, this is how much you could make. I think we need to have those conversations all the way through. I think we should encourage students to ask professionals about their work. What is your job like every day? The work is one thing, the job is another. You know, how much of your job is spent doing administrative things, or how much of your job is spent doing care duties that aren't music therapy, but that are required by your facility. And I don't know that young people know to ask those questions. You know, what 18-year-old thinks about paid vacation or disability insurance or sick leave?
Right. Yeah. Ooh, give me so many good ideas for the students that I work with.
Yeah. And my students that, you know, did practicum field work with me or internships with me were exposed to all of that. They went to all of my meetings with me and they had budget lessons with me. You know, this is how we run the department and this is what this person does. And, you know, there was full transparency.
Yeah. Transparency. Sounds like we need some more of that.
I agree.
So what effect do you see that people leaving has on the field? And now we're getting kind of outside the bounds of your study, I think.
Yes and no, because I'm one of those people kind of leaving the profession and looking back and thinking, well, you know, we're not developing other opportunities. If we all leave in 5 to 10 years, we can't develop leadership positions. We can't develop business skills and leadership skills, and we can't become established in our communities. I hear some therapists complaining that we look flaky because people don't stay in their contract jobs for very long. Well, why would they? It's a terrible job. You know, the work might be amazing, but the job is terrible.
Yeah. I've got one kid who, when I started working with them, their mom was like, if you're just going to leave in 2 years, like, we want to find somebody else, because his last therapist stayed for 2 years. The one before that was here for 2 years.
And 2 years is a long time to be in a contract job.
Mm-hmm.
If you're the one trying to pay your bills with that contract job.
Yeah.
So I think that when we lose therapists, you know, we're losing really smart, skilled people in our communities. We are losing opportunities to build other jobs. We're losing opportunities for our communities and our facilities to see what an experienced clinician looks like. There's a big difference between a brand new clinician and someone with 10 years of experience.
Oh, Lord, yes. I just started getting supervised by someone with like 20 plus years of experience.
Mm-hmm.
And it has made a world of difference.
Right. So can you imagine if your community only saw people with 2 years of experience ever?
It's a scary thought.
Well, it happens so much of the time. It happens. Or, you know, if they only see students coming out of one training program with one theoretical orientation. Or if the therapists are so desperate, they'll take any job, whether or not the job is ethical in how it treats the clients or the theoretical orientation aligns with how they were trained. You know, it's difficult to work in. Like, I could not work in a behavioral setting, like applied behavioral analysis setting. I'm not trained for that. I'm not wired for that. But if I were desperate, I mean, I could see a young person taking a job and just trying to make it work. So that's not good for the therapist or the client or the business. And I also think without experienced clinicians out in our communities, we don't have oversight. I don't know how many times I've observed another clinician for one reason or another and thought, when is the last time you had some supervision? Like, that should not be happening.
Yeah, I think lack of supervision is a huge, huge thing.
It is, and I don't know how we can expect therapists to pursue it when they can't afford it, they can't find it.
Right, and there's
when
not...
would they do it? And so we pay lip service to it. I think when you look at the code of ethics and you look at all the competencies, it looks great on paper. But in reality, unless you work in a large practice or in a facility where there are lots of therapists, it's not happening.
Right. Yeah, I feel like that's a good thing, a good like summary of a lot of our profession, maybe, is we give a lot of lip service to a lot of great things. But like, do we back that up?
Right.
Questions for everybody at home to answer.
Right. I mean, wouldn't it be amazing if CBMT had this roving team of experienced clinicians that did spot checks on programs or on individuals, just, you know, check in, let me observe you. How are you doing? How can we help you? Those kinds of things.
Ooh, that's a cool idea. Huh. Do other professions have those things? Like,
I don't know.
I guess I just don't know what I don't know.
I can think of in the hospital saying there's JCO, or in a nursing home, there's the Inspector General. They drop in.
Yeah, I guess I just don't know.
I used to shadow my staff. They knew that I could pop up on a unit anytime and observe their session, and they could do the same to me. It was a two-way street. So I loved hearing them work, and I hope that they sneaked in and watched me work too sometimes.
That's a cool idea that you could both do that.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah, I love that. Did anybody regret leaving the field?
I don't know that they regretted it. They were pretty consistently sad. Only one person wasn't sad. That person left the field for something completely different and loved their new thing and was like, nope, this is what I was supposed to do. They were sad. They didn't want to leave. They felt like consistently they had worked hard for that degree. They had worked hard for that certification. Most of them felt like they were very good at it, at being a music therapist. And so they were sad that they didn't get to do it or couldn't continue in that field. Some of them said they would return if they could find a sustainable job. I think three of them said, yeah, I would consider a return to the profession if I could find one job that could pay my bills and had benefits. And multiple said, I still identify as a music therapist. You know, even though I might be a lawyer or a nurse or a teacher or whatever other job they're doing now, they're like, in my heart, I'm still a music therapist.
Wow. I think that says something pretty powerful.
It does. And I find myself tripping over that question when people ask me what I do. I did have a couple of participants where we had to pause the interview or change the line of questioning because they became so emotional talking about it. So there was definitely grief still, very raw under the surface for the participants.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like if they loved it so much that they made it a piece of their identity, that it's who they are.
Right.
I can't imagine giving that up. Yeah. Ooh. What do you think needs to be done to keep people around?
I think we have to ask these hard questions. Yeah, I think we need to have better information on who's working and who's not and why not and how can we help.
Who does that start with?
Oh, I don't know. That's such a it's such a big question. We don't have full engagement and trust of the music therapy community now with any of the governing bodies or oversight. You know, the reporting is voluntary other than your board certification. And I tried to complete the profile for CBMT and the AMTA workforce survey, but they don't really have space for someone who's unemployed. So you can't even report that if you wanted to. You can't say, I worked 0 hours as a music therapist last year.
Oh.
And I feel like maybe if we started there, like, let's see how many people bite, how many people would fill that out. I would. I think it's important for people to know there's a gap. And some of the surveys that graduate students or university programs are sending out to collect information on the workforce will throw you out of the survey if you mark you're unemployed. And I've emailed some of those surveyors saying, hey, I'm trying to complete this and I feel like my data is important. They're like, well, no, we don't. So basically they don't want your information if you're not working, is what it feels like.
Sometimes I question some of the surveys I get. I wonder who put them together.
I have to send a lot of them back. Like, no, this is not a good survey question. So I don't know. It's such a big question, but we have to find a way to answer it. We have to gather that information. And maybe one place to start is with CBMT. When people don't recertify, set up a system so it contacts them to say, hey, we noticed you didn't submit your CMTEs and you didn't recertify this cycle. Are you okay? And why not? What do you need? Do you plan to reenter the profession? Are you leaving the profession? Like, that would be a place to start. But, you know, as we've seen casually and in my study, people are maintaining their board certification, but not working in the profession. So there still needs to be a way to capture when they leave the profession, when they're working in another area.
We've asked a lot of questions that don't have answers. So
that is the hallmark of a good study. A good study raises questions.
So these are difficult questions. I'm wondering, and it's okay if you don't, but I'm wondering if you have something that we as individuals could do or where to start, or because I feel like these are a lot of tricky questions, a lot of thorny questions, and it leaves me with a feeling of like, oh no, and dread. And I'm like, I wonder if there's some like little empowerment thing. And it's, I mean, maybe not. Maybe we have to sit with that feeling for a while.
Maybe. Folks could always, they can always contact me. I will listen. But I think let's let AMTA and CBMT know when we're struggling. Even if they can't do anything right away, just letting them know that there are people out here struggling. And even if that means they connect them to one another, at least the alone feeling is maybe decreased and maybe they can mobilize something. But I think increasing awareness that there's more than one way to do things. It doesn't always have to be contract work forever. It doesn't always have to be activity assistant work forever. But we have to find a way to keep people in the profession so that we can become established in the eyes of others.
Do you feel like we're established?
No. I feel there are pockets of established programs that are very visible. But I don't know that we spend enough time discussing the fact that those are few and far between, that most of us are just out trying to patch together work.
Okay. Give me a lot to think about, a lot to wrestle with. I like it. So you mentioned you're leaving the field. Where are you going? Do you know?
I don't know. So I have been without work for 2 years and I have been actively seeking work. I have looked in other states. I have been willing to move at different times for the right job, but unable to find any work that pays more than $15 an hour. So actually, there are a couple of music therapy jobs posted in my city. One was posted at $10 an hour and one was $15, and they were contract. So after 2 years of searching, and even searching for related jobs, not necessarily just music therapy. So I was willing to look outside of the profession at similar things, maybe research assistant, things like that. I was just like, you know, after 2 years, this is crazy. If I were my client, I would be like, it's time to pack it in. I feel like I gave it a really good try, used my best networking and, you know, everything skills. So I did get some really interesting projects that came out of it and connected with some people, but it wasn't enough to be sustainable. And, you know, with the situation in our culture right now, in our country, and with the economy and health issues, like this is not doable. So I'm actually looking at coordinator positions in philanthropy departments with nonprofits. So budget planning, fundraising, grant writing was a large part of my job when I worked for the hospital corporation. And so taking that experience and my leadership experience and using that, my skills as a therapist are great in assessing people and asking open-ended questions and using active listening. So I think that working in a department that interfaces with donors and grantors and funders would be relevant. So I'm looking for organizations that have a cause I'm passionate about that benefit other people in my community, and just hoping that they will understand how the skills transfer across industries.
Yeah. Okay. Can people find your thesis somewhere? Can people find your study somewhere?
Not yet. I'm getting it ready to submit. And I think I will submit it first to Voices so that there's open access.
Yay. Oh, I love Voices.
Yeah. I would love to get it in the Journal of Music Therapy, but not everyone can afford access to that. So.
Very true. Very true. Okay. You ready for our last little chunk? Is there anything else you wanted to add before we move on to our last little chunk of the cute little personal questions?
Folks can always email me, Facebook me, contact me. I'm happy to answer questions and to answer the hard questions. I'm fine with that.
Ah, I love that. Beautiful. Okay. What was your favorite part of being a music therapist?
I loved almost all of it. I was able to work in a facility that trusted me and let me do what needed to be done. So we were able to develop protocols when and where they were needed, which was so exciting to me to have a problem and to have the resources and the support to problem solve it, to figure out how to fix this. So whether it was in critical care or outpatient rehab, I loved the range of patients that I was able to work with. I love that we were able to just do the right thing when it was needed. And just that feeling of connection. There's nothing like it. Even when the person is on the ventilator and can't sing with you, you know when they know you're there. And so to be able to provide that sense of human and connection in times when it's so hard to feel connected to anything, that was just the best thing.
Yeah. What was your least favorite or the hardest part?
Dealing with administrators. When I had great administrators that were open and supportive, it was wonderful. But when you don't have those, it's horrible. It's a terrible feeling to go in every day and wonder what argument you might meet with. So that was probably the hardest part. So again, it wasn't the work, it was the job. The work of being with the patients and the families, that it was hard and intense, but that wasn't what caused burnout.
There you have it. Lots of big questions with no easy answers. But I think we need to have more of these types of discussions and to be asking these questions, which is why I started the podcast in the first place. After I turned off the recording, Jenny and I chatted for a few more minutes, and she mentioned something that I thought was really important. We were talking about the composition of our profession in regards to race and gender and things like that. And she mentioned that our makeup is influenced by who can afford to be a music therapist, who can afford to get a 4-year degree, work an unpaid internship for 6 months, and then survive off contract work with low hourly wages with little or no benefits. Another one of those systemic issues we need to think critically about if we're going to solve the problem of our mostly homogenous professional body. So, dear listeners, what in this episode resonated for you? We love hearing from you. Email us at mtpodcast@gmail.com, follow and DM us on Instagram at mtpodcast, and don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review our podcast wherever you listen. And now for some final words from Jenny Branson on how music has impacted her life.
It would be easier to say how it has not. I grew up in a family with music at home, and attending music and being a musician. So it's kind of everything. I still perform as an amateur, and I still go to performances, and I still take lessons. So it's a way for me to be energized and to relax and to connect and to escape and to just do all the things. And I think I love to think of all the people I know because of my life in music. It's such a beautiful range of people across generations and countries. And it's just an amazing glue, really.
1, 2, 3, 4. This episode was hosted by Tony Boykel, produced by Nathan Sheets. Original music composed and performed by Nathan Sheets and Tony Boykel.